So, at any rate, Rashi tells us then that King Jehoiachin and people who had gone with him to Babylonia, they decided to build a shul, okay? Sofi Yosef. They built it with stones and with dust. They actually had taken this with them into captivity from Jerusalem, the Kayem HaShenemar, in order to fulfill what it says in a verse in Tehillim, where it says, Ki rotzu avodecho es avonecho v'yesafaro yechonenu. Because your servants, meaning, you know, the Jewish people, they love the stones of Eretz Yisrael, and they find favor, or they embrace, it's probably a better translation, they embrace the very dust, the very soil of Eretz Yisrael. So they took it with them, they took with them stones and soil from Eretz Yisrael, in order to use it, in order to build for them a synagogue in Babylonia.
Yeah, now, the thing about it, the whole concept of synagogue actually did not exist before, right? They had the temple.
It may or may not. Because yeah. We have a pasuk in Tehillim which says, Sofro called that a Sheva Oretz, okay, which means that there were places where people would gather in order to daven together, to recite songs or something or other. But of course, the Beis HaMikdosh, that was the main sanctuary.
Yeah.
So that may have already existed prior. But certainly, synagogues began flourishing in Babylonia. Right,
yeah.
Where this is where the Jews gathered in order to find consolation in their goals, in order to have the strength in order to continue.
So it was their idea, right as they were leaving, that they were going to have a gathering place when they got there, and it was going to be from the stones and the dust of Jerusalem.
I just wanted to mention one other thing, that the prophet who went to Babylonia together with this first group,
who?
The predominant, the outstanding prophet who went, it happened to be Yechezkel.
Yeah.
Because his prophecies are in Babylonia.
Yeah.
And the first half, he predicted the destruction of Yerushalayim because of the sins of the people of Israel that he had witnessed. But in the second half, he speaks about the return to Eretz Yisrael, and the very, very stirring passages, and then the ideal Beis HaMikdash, which would be rebuilt after the Jews went back to Eretz Yisrael.
Isn't Yehoshua also
Yehoshua?
I mean,
that's Yehoshua, Kayan Godel, you mean?
No.
Jeremiah was
Yeshayahu. Well, that depends upon whether you consider Yeshayahu from our traditional point of view or from the non-traditional point of view. Okay. The traditional point of view is that we know that he lived during the days of Yeshayahu, Amon, and so on, the kings of Judah, right? Chosyas, Yehu, and so on. But that he had Ruach HaKodesh, and so therefore he was able to foresee, you know, that Jews eventually would go to Babylonia, and then he became the prophet in which, you know, he had this vision of the restoration of the Golus there, which is, of course, I don't have to do it.
By the waters of Babylon, from whom does that...
This is a psalm. Psalm 137.
It's a psalm.
Psalm 137.
One of David's songs.
Right.
Most of the Jews were in Israel during the first temple, right? Yes.
Well, I don't know that we have a percentage, but it is true that already in the days of Yeshayahu, there were already Jewish communities outside of Eretz Israel as well.
They didn't go back during the Second Temple, they stayed where they were.
Many people did, no question about that. But it's interesting that there was already a diaspora in the last days of the first temple period, right? Because he predicts, you know, that involved in there is Ashur, right? Those who are lost on the lands of Assyria, the Anidochim there is Mitzrayim, right? And those who are cast away in the land of Egypt, and the Yishtachol Hashem HaKadosh Baruch Hu, they'll all come back to the holy mountain of God in Yerushalayim, and there they will worship again. So in other words, he foresaw, you know, there were already Jews living in various areas, but he looked forward to the day when they would all return to Israel.
Assyria, were those ten, the 10 tribes from Israel, right?
Right, it's correct. They were captured already, by the Assyrians,
that happened earlier, correct.
Okay, let me get a steam, so we'll do just a little bit long to call it night tonight, okay? All right. So at any rate, in Babylonia, we find that Abaye said that the Shekhinah is to be found in the synagogue in Hutzel, right? And also in the synagogue of Shofar Yosef, which is located in Nahar Dovah.
Oh, the second one, the one that was built by
Yehoiachin? Yeah, by Yehoiachin and the Jews who accompanied him, right. And he says, well, no Tamar, hocha v'hocha. And don't say that the Shekhinah was here and here simultaneously. Elo zimnin hocha. Sometimes they were here, but zimnin hocha, sometimes the Shekhinah was to be found there. Omar Abaye, Abaye said, furthermore, he said, "Basically, the chi barchikna pasa ayalonim atzlinla hasam." Says, and may the Rebbeinu Shalom reward me for the fact that when I am at a distance of a parsa is a parasite, which is roughly about 3.5 miles or something like that. If I'm anywhere, you know, at a distance, you know, or nearer, obviously, then in that particular case, I walk, I enter, and I pray over there. In other words, I'll go out of my way in order to pray over there because I feel the Shekhinah is there. Okay, now there's another story about this shul, okay? Abu Hod Shmuel, Shmuel's father, Shmuel, remember, was by... Zoe Shmuel and Robin Shmuel, okay? But his father also was a distinguished scholar, okay? And Levi, who was another distinguished scholar, Avu Yaspe Beknishta, the Shofar Yosef, they were happened to be sitting in this particular Shofar Yosef synagogue in Har Dor. And what happened? Asya Shechina, Shechina came. Shomu Kol Rigsho, so they felt terrible, a sound of great stirring. So what happened? Koma v'nofko, they were afraid and they left the shul. Rav Sheshes, Avi Yosef Beknishta, he was sitting in the shul in the Shofar Yosef in the Hardor, and Atzio Shechina, and again the Shechina came over there, the Lo Nofak, and he did not go out. Now Rashi explains that Rav Sheshes was blind, and so therefore he could not see what was happening over there, but you know, he felt terrible stirring going on over there. So what was causing the stirring? It says Osu Malachei Hashoris, angels came, the Komivasulei, and they started in to threaten him, to frighten him. So Omar Lefonov, Rabbeinu Shalom, so he said to the Rabbeinu Shalom, all of the Sheinu Olam, a person who is persecuted, or one who is not persecuted, Mi nitchem et nemi, who should get priority before whom? So Amaluhu, so the Rabbeinu Shalom said to the angels, Shavkuhu, leave him alone. So in other words, he felt the presence, but the Rabbeinu Shalom took his course. And then we come to a very famous quotation. There's a pasuk in Yechezkel which says, "Vahi lahem mikdash mi'at," and I have become for them a small sanctuary. I'm sure you've probably heard the expression before, right? So, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, what do we mean by a small Beis HaMikdash? What is a small Beis HaMikdash? Which is really what, how I should translate it, right? So Rabbi Yitzchak said, Eilu Bote Kenesios Uvote Medrashos Shebe Bavel. These are the synagogues and the Bote Medrash, you know, where they learn Torah in Babylonia. They are like small Bote Mikdash, right? Like small temples, small sanctuaries. Rabbi Eliezer Omar, he said, Ze Beis Rabbeinu Shebabel. This is the home of our rabbi, meaning Rav, in Babylonia. This also in his home, they study Torah, so it is a small sanctuary. Dorash Rava, Rava gave the following drash. He says, My Dichsiv, what is the meaning of the Pasuk that says in Tehillim, Ad Hashem, Mo'on Ato Yisalonu, O God, you have been our dwelling place. He says, Eilu Bote Kedesius Vote Midrash. This refers to the synagogues and to the Bote Midrash. Omar Abaye said, Meiresh, once upon a time, he says, to begin with, literally, Havai Gristo Beveso, Umatzlino Beve Kedishna. I used to learn at home, and then I would daven in shul. But Kevin Nishom is the Hod the Kamar David. But then when I understood this pasuk, which King David said in Tehillim, where it says, Ad Hashem, Wahafti Miyom Visecha, O Lord, I love the dwelling place of thy house or the habitation of thy house. You know, it's always a question how you translate, right? So have I Grista Viknishta? So then I decided that from this point on I would go and learn in the shul. Tanya, we have another teaching. Rabbi Elazar Kapor, he said, Asidin Bote Kenesios, Bote Midrosh Shebebovel, Sheikot Beretz Yisrael. The day will come when the shuls, and when the Bote Medrash, in other words, the houses of study in Babylonia, will be established in Eretz Yisrael. They'll all come back to Eretz Yisrael. Shenemar, as it is written, and this is a little very difficult because the literal translation is not exactly how he made the drash, but it's written in the book of Yom Yohu, it's written over there, Ki kesovor behorim uchacham el bayom yobo. Literally it means, because like, just as Mount Tabor is there among the various mountains, and like Carmel is there by the sea, Yovo, there he's referring, you know, to the enemy, to Nebuchadnezzar, will be coming. But how do they take it? They take it in a different sense. They take it in the following drash. It says, Ki Ketzover Behorim, he says, you know, just like Tover among the various mountains, and like Mount Carmel, which stands by the sea, Yovo, you know what they did? They all came, these two mountains came in order to join Mount Sinai at the giving of the Torah. Okay? So, hallo devarim kal v'chomer. Can't we learn from this, you know, a kal v'chomer? In other words, if this is so, then certainly something else. Ama tovor v'chamel, just as the case of Mount Tabor and Mount Carmel, shelo bo elo l'fi sho'ot, lumo Torah, they came only for a temporary stay, in order to learn Torah. In other words, they came to Mount Sinai in order to learn Torah, and they didn't stay there. But nevertheless, they are Nikmayim be'Eretz Yisrael. Nevertheless, where are they settled? In Eretz Yisrael. Okay? So therefore, both they can see so what they've been roshes, the shuls, and the Batei Medrash, the Korin Marbitza Behem Torah, where they read Torah, where they spread Torah, Al achas kama v'chama. All the more so that they will come to Eretz Yisrael. Dorash Bar Kapora. Bar Kapora gave the following drasha. He says, "My dichziv, what is the meaning of?" And again, it's also from Tehillim. It says, "Lama teratzdu nahorim gavdunim." Why do you mountains which are gavdunim? Question is what it means. One translation is lofty, but at any rate, We'll see in a second another possibility. Why do you leap, or why do you carry on like this? So Yotze Bas Kol V'yom Lahem, a Bas Kol, a heavenly voice came and said unto them, Loma Teratzu Din Im Sinai. Why do you have an argument with Mount Sinai? In other words, why do you want to covet for yourself, and you don't want to give the covet to Mount Sinai? Kuchem Balei Mumin, you are all blemished, Eitz Har Sinai, in comparison to Mount Sinai. Because Mount Sinai, in connection with Mount Sinai, Ksiv, it's written, Ocho Gavnunim. In other words, the Pasuk over here says, Gavnunim, right? The Pasuk that we quoted from Tilim. Uchsiv Hosom, and then we come to say Vayikra, and we find that it's written that a Kohen who is O Gibein, O Dak, in other words, he has. It's a question as to what it means. Some say that Gibein means that he is hunched, another say dark, that he has a sty in his eye or something, he has a blemish. At any rate, he is blemished, right? So that what? He's not allowed to carry on the sacrificial system in the Beis HaMikdash because he's a Baal Mum. You understand? So, if these mountains are called Horim Gavnunim, then in that case it means also that the mountains are also Balimun, right? In other words, they have a blemish. And that's the reason why they are called Horim Gavnunim, based on the word Gibein. Okay. So, at any rate, we see, and then what Rashi say? Omer Rav Ashi says, Shema Mino, from this we learn something else, that Hai Mandi Yohir, that if a person is arrogant, proud, not in the sense of good pride, but you know, bad pride, right? So he is a Baal Mum, is also a person with a blemish. Just as the mountains had blemish when they were Horeb Gavnunim, so likewise he is also a person.
So the blemish had to do with the they're trying to compare themselves to Sinai or to.
Yeah, right.
And so that was a blemish?
Exactly, right. There's another version of it which says, you know, that they said, Rebbeinu Shel Olam, why are you giving the Torah on Mount Sinai? This is among the lowly mountains, and not among the highest mountains. Why don't you give it on the high mountain? You know? So the answer is, again, it's not, you know, you compare yourself out of your pride, but Rebbeinu Shel Olam decided to choose a place which was a modest place, because modesty is one of the great virtues that the Yiddishkeit has to teach. Okay, so we shall stop at this point. B'yot HaShem. Alright, tonight is the fifth. Yeah, the fifth already, right. Tonight is the 5th of February of the year 2003. We are continuing now from towards the bottom of Daf Lamed Chavtes. But will be 29A towards the bottom in Maseches Megillah, and we'll continue from where we left off the previous week. Okay. Now, remember at this particular point, in analyzing the Mishnah that started this particular section, we were talking about the holiness of a synagogue, and incidentally, they also brought in what is permissible. Behavior, what is not permissible behavior if you go to a Beis Elam, to a cemetery. So this is now what they're dealing with. Okay. One of the things that the Mishnah had to say is, in Eise Neise Kapandria, that you do not make a shul into a shortcut. Okay? In other words, come to a shul, treat it respectfully, and don't use it as a shortcut to get from one place to another. So the question is, under what circumstances is it possible, maybe, that permission would be given? So Omar Rab Chelbo, Rab Chelbo said, Omar Rabbi Chananya, that the Hadichdas, the Beis HaKnesses, the Ispalel, if someone enters a shul in order to daven, Mutar La'aseis HaKapandria, then in that particular case, he's not there with the intention to begin with. in order to make it a kapantri, in order to make it a shortcut to wherever he's going. But he's there to daven, and then if there's a shorter way, you know, to get to his destination, it's permissible. Shenemar, and let's see, did I skip something? Yeah, I think I skipped something. Okay. Oh boy, did I skip lines over here. Sorry. Shows that my eyes are making a shortcut. These days I have to have an operation. Oh well. All right. So, all right, to get back again. All right. First question that they ask now is, what do we mean, right? My kapandria. What does the word kapandria mean? Obviously, it was not the word that was so familiar in their vocabulary, so they want to know, what is it? So, Amar Rava, so Rava gave the following answer. Okay, he said, kapandria. It's kishma. Exactly the way it sounds, that's what it is. My kishma, so what do you mean? It's exactly the way it sounds. This is what it is. It says, Kimandu Amar. It's as if somebody said, Ademakifna Adore. In other words, Makifna Adore. In other words, Kapandriya is sort of a combination of the two words, you know. So, Eyul Beho. So he says, if a person says, for example, why should I go around this row, let's say this row of houses or something like that, I'll go in this way, in other words, the short way. Okay, so therefore he says that kapandriya is from that. Of course, in reality, it happens to be based on a Latin word, okay, which meant a short way, obviously. But you have to understand that in Babylonia they weren't great experts on Latin, okay. Of course, they didn't talk Latin over there. In Eretz Yisrael, they spoke Latin. I mean, at least they understood Latin because, you know, the Roman government was there. So you have people who understood Latin, they understood Greek, just as, you know, they understood Aramaic. So, but...
That's the question that I was just going to ask.
What was the spoken language?
The spoken language was not Latin, was it? I mean, not classical Latin.
You mean, what was the spoken language of the Jews?
No, what was the spoken language of the Romans?
Of the Romans. The Romans spoke Latin, however.
There was a verbal version of Latin.
Yeah, definitely.
Latin that we know of from the books.
Yeah, right, right.
Latin.
Yeah.
Was also used in conversation?
It was used in common conversation, absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, you think, there's no question about that. I used to fool around with another Latin teacher in classical high, that we would talk a little Latin to each other.
Nobody could understand.
Right. That was the one before, the one who died young.
Not the priest.
No, the one who died young. What was his name again?
I think that was before my time.
Yeah, okay.
That was before I went down there and after I was a student.
Right, he was teaching
Marty, did you go to class one?
Yeah.
Latin teacher there?
I went from 67 to 70.
Yeah, I forget what his name was. Well, all right, it doesn't matter at this particular point. He was a very nice guy, so I would fool around with him, just as I would speak French on the French teachers, I would speak Latin to him just to fool around with him. Okay, so there's no question that Latin was a spoken language, and the truth of the matter is, I took courses in Latin comedy, Plautus, Terence, and so on. They wrote comedies. Matter of fact, Plautus's comedies formed the basis for Shakespeare, for Molière, even for modern ones. Like, for example, you know, the business, funny thing happened to me on the way to the forum.
Yeah.
This is based originally upon Plautus, okay?
So, based on what?
Plautus's comedies. And, you know, there you have Latin as they were talking to each other, because after all, he wasn't writing highfalutin Latin, you understand? But he was writing, you know, the Latin that an average theater goer would understand, you know, quite well. So they spoke it. However, as far as the Jews were concerned, they spoke Latin primarily only in relation to government officials, okay? For them, they needed Latin.
Otherwise, it was Aramaic and...
Also
and
Greek.
Hebrew.
Aramaic, Greek, and Hebrew, right, because many people in the Near East spoke either Aramaic or Greek. So they really had to be fluent in the several different languages. And as a result, words crept in into the language of the Mishnah that came either from Latin sources or from Greek sources. And of course, as time goes on, you know, they change a little bit in their shape or anything like that. But this is really the origin of it. But the Babylonian scholars were not great Latin students, so that, you know, they came up with a different interpretation, okay? All right. So, at any rate, they say, what is Capandria? Instead of going around this way, we'll cut through this way. All right, so now we know what Capandria means, okay? And, excuse me, yeah. All right, so Rabbi said, if, let's say, however, there was a pathway that already had existed even before they built the shul, then in that particular case, you're permitted to use that as a shortcut. Because in that case, I mean, it was already in existence. What shall we say? Sort of like a grandfather's clause, okay? Amar Rav Nachman by Yitzchak. Here's where my eyes skipped it before. So Rav Nachman by Yitzchak said, "Hanichnos al benos shelo lasos kapanvio." If somebody comes into the shul without the intention of making it as a shortcut, then muta lasos kapanvio. Then, if he changes his mind afterwards, either he's davened a little, or whatever it was the purpose that he came into the shul. Then, if he wants to, then he can make the shul, you know, into a kapadri, into a shortcut. The other Rab Chelbo, that's probably a hay over there. In my book, I can't tell the difference whether it's a hay or a ches, but it's probably a hay. So Amar Rab Huna said, "Hanichnos leis haknesos es palem." If a person comes into shul in order to daven, then in that particular case, you can certainly use it as a shortcut if you want to, you know, to leave by another exit, which will make it shorter to get to the destination after you have finished davening. Shenemar, we have a pasuk. Good evening. We have a pasuk, and this comes from the book of Yechezkel. Okay. In the book of Yechezkel, I think I've mentioned it from time to time. The last part of the second half of the book of Yechezkel consists of two major sections. Section number one is words of consolation to the people of Israel to say that they're going to rebuild Eretz Israel and that God is doing it for his own name's sake. In other words, because the Goyim had already cast all kinds of aspersions upon the people of Israel, upon their God, so that God is zealous for his own name. And this is where we have, for example, the description of what Eretz Israel will be like, namely that the cities will once more be rebuilt, the vineyards will again flourish, and the mountains will be covered with all kinds of foliage and everything else, and so on and so forth. And the people of Israel are coming, followed immediately by the vision of the Valley of the Dry Bones, where, if you recall, the message there was the fact that the people of Israel say, "We have no hope, we're dead," and Ezekiel is there in order to encourage them, to tell them that they are not dead. As long as the Spirit of God is within them, it is possible for them to become alive once more. And that is followed again by the vision that the people of Israel will become a united people. Ephraim and Judah will no longer be angry at each other, but they will join together under the leadership of a descendant of King David. So, and then from that point on, the next thing that he has is that nevertheless, there's going to be a war waged against the people of Israel, This is what we call the war of Gog and Magog, okay? But then the very last part of the book of Yechezkel deals with a vision of a new Beis HaMikdash to be rebuilt. This I did mention, I think, a week ago or so. There will be a new Beis HaMikdash. It will be rebuilt, and he gives his specifications and the procedure that will be followed and so on. So, as part of the procedure, he says as follows, and this is the pasuk that they quote, "Uvedol am ha'oretz l'fnei Hashem," and when the people of the land come before the Lord, Moadim, on the festivals, in other words, when they come to make pilgrimages on the festivals, "Habo derech shar tzafon hishtachavos," if somebody comes in through the gate of the north in order to prostrate himself, then Yetze derech shar negev, he leaves by way of the southern gate. And of course, the pasuk continues, and the person who comes in from the south will leave by the north. So, if this is the case, we see on this basis that it is possible, even right. So, even though it says specifically in Gemara Brachas that you're not allowed to make the temple mount into a kapandria, but nevertheless, there is justification if you come in order to pray, and so on, and in that particular case, it could go out the other way.
So it's like okay. There's an entrance and an exit.
Right, right. Yeah. Okay. And now we continue over here. Okay. Then, getting back again, we said that what is the case if either in a shul which has become ruined? Remember we spoke about that. Beis HaKnesses, right? Shul which has become ruined, or even a cemetery. Okay? And what do we find? We find Oluba Sovim. Grasses have grown up in it. Okay? So, the Mishnah tells us, Lo Yitlosh, you should not pluck them up, right? Don't pull them up. They Agmas Nefesh. Because this way, it will make you feel sad when you see, you know, like weeds and grasses growing where people have passed away and then no one is there to pay attention to them. So feeling that I get sometimes when I go into a Beis Elam in New York City and you see that, you know, people have passed away 70, 80 years ago, they may not have any descendants left after them, and so you find that the grasses are overgrown over there and so on. Of course, I mean, sometimes people, families will arrange for what they call perpetual care, which means that maybe once or twice a year, you know, the grass will be cut. But the question is, again, you know, when you see the grass is growing and you see it's overgrown, how do you feel about it? You feel agmas nefesh, as we say.
The question is, if it's overgrown,
yeah,
is no repairing it if it's already gotten overgrown. You're not allowed to come in and
clean
it up.
Well, we'll see. I'll discuss that in a couple of minutes. Okay? Yeah. It's never long. I jump to conclusions.
Well, I'm doing A, B, C, D.
I know. I understand. Okay. We have to learn sometimes a little patience also.
Right.
Oh,
very much so.
So, now they question that. They say, oh, Tanya, didn't we learn in another baraisa, it says, Eino toleish u'ma'achil. A person is not allowed to pluck up the grass, pull it out, and then feed it to his animals. You understand? Avol toleish u'maniach. But he is permitted to pluck
clean
it
up.
Up and simply
clean it
let it stay, you know, drop it, right? So he says, Kitnan. And likewise, when we learn in our Mishnah, so Nami Masnison, then the Mishnah too is really trying to teach us the same thing. Namely, Tehle Shemachil Tanan. When it says, do not pluck up the grass, it means that not to pluck it up in order to feed it to an animal, in other words. So, you know, let's say a sheep, a goat, whatever may come in over there. Tanu Rabbanan. So we have a similar statement which reinforces this. It says, Beis HaKvoros, if it is a cemetery, a noagin bahen kalas rosh. You're not allowed to act in a lightheaded manner in a cemetery. In other words, you have to be serious when you go into a cemetery. Just as we learned, when you go into a shul, you have to also, it's prohibited to have kalas rosh. You must be serious in the fact that you're here in order to daven and so on and so forth, and treat with respect. And even, as we said, what used to be a shul and is currently in ruins, but nevertheless, you still have to show respect for it. So, in the cemetery, it says, "Ein nohagin behen kalas rosh," and, for example, "Ein marid behen behemot." Don't bring in an animal over there in order to feed, you know. "V'yein molichin behem amas hamayim," nor do you use the cemetery ground in order to cut like a little canal, a little channel for irrigation purposes of a field or something like that. Yeah. Okay? Doesn't mean that you can't run a line in a cemetery in order to wash your hands afterwards, which is a different problem. Because in Springfield, I have to tell you, they shut off the water and all of that because they're afraid, you know, of the winter when it happens. So it's no longer possible to do it at the cemetery.
At all? I mean, even in the summertime?
Even in the summer, they don't open it up.
How does whatever grasses are there, they depend strictly on rain?
Yeah.
They have no watering system of any
sort.
They have it, yeah.
A little faucet, yeah.
For washing
hands.
Yeah, but we're talking about irrigating
the place. Yeah, but I noticed that. Yeah, but as a general rule, it's not working. I know it's been irrigating, right, yeah. Okay. But anyway, here we're talking about the fact that, you know, how did they irrigate fields in those days? The answer is that they would cut, let's say, a little channel or something like that,
yeah,
and
bring
water.
Yeah.
No, bring water
from
a source of water someplace. This was particularly true in Babylonia, where it was much easier to. You had canals crisscrossing the area over there, so that there was really plentiful water over there. Yeah. Iraq has made a desert of it, but once upon a time it was a very flourishing area. Just as, you know, we think of what the Goyim in all the centuries when the Jews were not in Eretz Israel, what did they do? Well, you know, that they neglected the land and it became a wilderness. But once upon a time it was flourishing, and this is what the Jews have done to make it flourishing once more. Even as Yechezkel, I told. Okay. All right, so. At any rate, you're not allowed to do that either in the cemetery. And we do not pluck, in this particular case. You see, the Baraisa over here stressed you're not to act with kalas rosh, right? With levity or disrespect in the cemetery. So it's started in by don't feed your animals there, right? And don't run the water stream through it in order to irrigate the neighboring field. The ain the locked in my head. That's something. Nor do we pluck up over there the grass. But the imli, of course, the what? As we learned already from the previous baraisa, means, you know, to feed your animals. And therefore, the imlikate. Let's say a person did pluck it up, so from imkoma, then in that case he burns, you know, these weeds and so on. In their place where he lets it drop, they quote Basim as in order to show honor to the dead. So they say, "Ahaya, well, what do you mean? What's haste? How does burning the grass show honor to the dead?" So he says, "Ilaymo, if you wish," he says, "a sefer." Then we're talking about the latter part of the statement that Kaven should so from him come on, inasmuch as you burn them over there. So I quote Basimiko. So what kind of covenant are we talking about? But rather, we have to refer to the first part of the statement, which says that we are not to behave in the cemetery with kalas rosh, with levity. So, to get back to your question, are we allowed to pluck the grass that is overgrown? The answer is yes. But do we burn them today? No, we don't burn them today. Because So that's what I asked. What kind of COVID to the dead is it to burn the grass? Obviously, the idea of the burning the grass, whoever propounded that idea, was that, you know, not to make any vain use of it,
right,
like feeding the animals.
Yeah, it shouldn't be a temptation
right.
For someone to bring their animals
right.
to eat.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Let's say...
Yeah.
Only people who have done.
Would you be denying the intent of, you know, as far as levity goes, saying you had all this grass collected and removed it from the cemetery? Now, could you use it to graze animals?
No, that would not be. In other words, it should be...
The purpose was not to get grass for grazing.
Right.
But the purpose was to make the cemetery neat.
Correct.
And once you removed it from the cemetery, could you use it for any purpose?
Strictly speaking, it should not be. It should not be. Based upon what the Gemara over here has to say. You should.
You know, but your intent was not original.
I understand very well, right. Uh-huh. Yeah. But the idea is also that from the dead people, you show honor to the dead by not using for any profane purpose. Okay.
You know, just like
right.
the intent to go into the show was not to take a shirt from.
Right.
But.
Yeah.
Since you were there on the way out, you could, you know, effectively make a shirt.
Right.
Would it be used to fertilize, you know, like to throw it around so that it disintegrates and fertilizes?
If it disintegrated by itself and fertilized the area, nobody's going to object to that.
No.
Right.
That, as a matter of fact, seems like a respectful thing to do, like
but,
dust to dust. Yeah.
Right. Now, I've seen one interpretation in connection with this. You know, not to display callous roche in the cemetery, don't eat and drink in the cemetery, which is at odds with what took place in Eastern Europe, where, you know, something that I saw many, many years ago, whenever, you know, when I was, you know, young, and I would see people would come over with the tradition that when you had, for example, an unveiling, they would bring schnapps, they would bring kichel and stuff
right
like that,
right
sit down
the,
and eat, or they'd make out bags of the food stuff and so on and so forth. That really is not right. They do that.
Oh.
They pick the cup of okay, so all I can say is that they don't have that tradition.
I don't know how maybe you would say it's not a graveyard because it's inside the cave, but still it's close enough.
What's the connection here to McGill? I understand this.
It's the connection with the fact that if you remember, just as the Sefer Torah has Kedusha, a shul has Kedusha, right?
I understand that. But what is that all?
So that therefore it leads to the next area, namely a cemetery also has Kedusha.
I understand that.
Okay, so that's what it is, right? And it wants to reinforce the idea of the Kedusha of a cemetery by saying not to act over there in Kalos Reish, but you are, you know.
I understand the connection with Megillah. The idea of Megillah, that has nothing to do with Megillah. How does it
happen? Oh, okay.
That's
the connection to begin with.
I mean, why did they stick it in here? Why didn't they put it in Brochus? Why didn't they put it in some other place,
okay.
You know?
A good question. First of all, there's a certain amount of cross-pollination that we find.
That
you have going on all
right,
along.
You have the discussion here, but maybe it's also
been
discussed someplace else.
Going
this seems to be the process, the whole process. They get going on, you know, and it's looking at all the very particulars.
It has branched out like that, whatever the common...
Oh, I understand they're branching out, but they've really gone far off here, you know, gone from reading the Megillah and the interpretation of Megillah and whatever is the Megillah, and all of a sudden they're in a cemetery, you know.
But that's because they want to show that a cemetery, too, is a Mokum Kodesh, it's a holy place, and therefore we should not behave disrespectfully over there. This is the basic idea. Now, the whole thing got started because of the fact that inasmuch as reading the Megillah has its rules and its regulations, so reading the Torah also has its rules and regulations.
That,
and at this particular point,
really
we are now ready for a Mishnah which deals now, which reading the Torah at problems that arise from
it. Okay, that sounds more.
Yeah.
More
so I have to stress at this particular point. Remember that these discussions took place 2,000 years ago. And at that time, in certain cases, things had not been completely formulated yet as to what the procedure would be. You would ask me today, what do we do, for example, on, let's say, Shabbos, Parsha Shkolo, which is the one that they deal with first, and if it happens to be also Rosh Chodesh. So I'll tell you, what we do today is to take our three Sefer Torahs, right? And the first one we call up six Aliyahs. The second one is the seventh one. And then the last, the third one is used as the Machter. So fine, very good. But that's our procedure today. And that's the way it's been, of course, for many, many hundreds of years. But this was not necessarily what happened 2,000 years ago when they started to discuss what to do in such a case. So that the Mishnah now is going to deal with this problem about Rosh Chodesh Adar. Okay? At the same time, yeah. Right. Matter of fact, we had Rosh Chodesh Adar just this past Sunday, right? But because this being, this being a leap year, so batteries. See? I've had no muzzle with it lately. Yeah, I'll have to put in new ones. Yeah.
See, the round ones?
Or the round ones, yeah.
Camo and long ones have cheap, but they work well.
Yeah. Okay. So, as I said, today I could tell you what we do in the shul. But at that time, they had to figure out what to do. And there were, therefore, different opinions as to what to do. Okay? So, the Mishnah at the bottom of Choftes Abed Aleph, fourth line from the bottom. The Mishnah says, Rosh Chodesh Adar, it is the first day of Adar, Shechol Yos B'Shabbos, and it is also on Shabbos. Okay? So on that particular Shabbos, Korin B'Farsha Shkolim. You have to read Parsha Shkolim. Now, as you know, we have four Parshas. We call them the Arba Parshios, right?
Yeah.
And Shkolim is the first one. Then we have Zohar. Remember, that's always before Purim. Okay. Then we have Porah. And we speak about the red heifer. And of course, that was used for purification purposes to get people ready for the pilgrimage to Yerushalayim. And then HaChodesh, which is the Shabbos in which we already begin talking about the actual preparations for Pesach, okay?
Parsha Shkolim was really April 15th for Jews then, right?
Right? To a certain extent, right. To a certain extent, yeah. Used to be March 15th back in the old days.
April
15th. I gave you a break.
No, March 15th would be closer to God at once.
Right, yeah. All right, so at any rate, Rosh Chodesh Adar happened to come on Shabbos, right. So on that particular Shabbos it says we have to read Parsha Shkolim. Now, Chol Liyos B'Seich HaShabbos, what if the first day of Adar is in the middle of the week? Remember that the word Shabbos in Hebrew has two different meanings over here in the Talmud. Either it means Shabbos, the Sabbath day, or Shabbos also means a week.
A week, really?
Right, yeah. Oh, I mean, look, what do we say every morning? Hayom Moshe B'Shabbos, Hayom Sheni B'Shabbos, and Shlishi B'Shabbos, and so on. What does it mean? Shlishi B'Shabbos. It means the third day of the week, right? Revi B'Shabbos, and so on. Okay. Yeah. So, Chol Yos B'Seich HaShabbos, what if the first day of Adar happens to occur in the middle of the week, then it says, Magdimim v'she'ovar, Mafsikim v'shabbos chodesh. Then in that particular case, you have to, first of all, read it before, that is, Parsha Shkolim. You read it before the first day of Adar. Right, the Shabbos prior to Rosh Chodesh Adar is Shkolim, okay? Umafsik in the Shabbos Acheres, and then the following Shabbos, in other words, the Shabbos that's going to follow Rosh Chodesh, at that particular point, there is a break. A break in the sense that it is not a special Shabbos. Okay? This year it's going to be, it's going to work out this year too, that way. That first we have Shkolim, right? Then the following Shabbos is just the regular Shabbos, okay? Mm-hmm. Then after that, you're going to have Parsha Zohar prior to Purim, and so on. And then the following week, Purim, and then the following week, Achodesh. This is the way it comes out this year, anyway, okay? Mm-hmm. In some years, there may be two pauses in between. If, let's say, Rosh Chodesh Nisan is on Shabbos, then in that particular case, you have something similar problem, you know, that you have to read three different Sefer Torahs also, because then it's going to be Parshas Lachodesh as well.
This year, when
right.
is Shkolim fall this but year?
Shkolim this year, it is before the second...
Before the second.
Right.
Okay, so it's 3 weeks from now.
Approximately.
3 weeks from now.
Yeah, correct.
Shumro,
Tetzaver, Kisisor, his birthday. Yeah, Shabbos, March 1st this year is going to be Shkolim.
Yeah, sure.
Then there'll be a break.
That's what he says, yeah.
Yeah, then the following week, in other words, on the 8th, it's just the regular Shabbos.
And
then
the 15th
will be
Zohar.
Exactly what it is. Exactly what it is, right.
Purim will be right before, for a few days.
Correct. Purim this year is Monday night and Tuesday, so the Shabbos prior to that is Parshas Zohar this year. Okay? But there are years in which the first day of the Chodesh Nisan happens to be on Shabbos. In that case, incidentally, that means that Pesach too is going to begin on Shabbos. So then we have to take out three Sefer Torahs that time. So there are three occasions during the year where it's possible to have three Sefer Torahs. I'm not talking about Sefer Torah, but I'm talking about, you know, where a Shabbos in which
you're Chodesh Nisan on Shabbos.
Right.
So you read
the Sedra, right. Then you read for Rosh Chodesh. And then after that, you read HaChodesh HaZelachim Rosh Chodesh. Because it's Pashas HaChodesh.
Because it's the first month.
Right. Okay. Right. Exactly. Okay. All right, so and then it says Bashlish is the third, of course, the third Shabbos then will be Pora Aduma, right?
About the
red heifer, the rules about that. And Boraviz, the fourth one, will be Achodesh HaZelachem, okay? And then it says Bachamish is on the fifth Shabbos, Hosel of Sidron, then in that particular case, you go back again just to the ordinary reading of the Torah. On Shabbos, okay.
No, but actually, you're reading the regular Torah anyway, aren't you?
Our custom is to do that.
Yeah,
but as we'll see from here, there was a difference in custom.
Oh, I see. Okay,
there was a difference in custom. Then it says, "Lakol mafsikin," they interrupt the regular reading of the Torah, the Rosh Chodeshim. For Rosh Chodesh, in other words, you have to read the Rosh Chodesh reading, right? The Chanukah, the Purim, right? You have to read the special readings for those days. The Ta'anios, on fast days. The Ma'amodos. Now, what are Ma'amodos? This we learned from the Gemara Tanis, if you remember, right? That Eretz Yisrael, we said, was divided into 24 different provinces, and every week, a different representation of Kahanim, Levim, and Yisraelim would come, and then back in the district, they would have special davening all week long, which they would read from Sefer Bereishis, Parshas Bereishis, you know, and so on. And they would also like the fast and things like that, and so on. Okay? So, that being the case, then what he's saying is that when you are in the Ma'amod, right, and it's your turn, then instead of reading the regular Shabbos reading that you normally would have read, so you read instead, you know, the special selections that are set aside for each day of the week of Ma'amodos, okay? And then of Yom Kippur.
We don't do that now. We don't do that now.
No. We don't have a Beis HaMikdash. We only know. By the way, I do want to say, since you raised the question, you know, our siddurim that we use in the shul, they don't have it. But the older siddurim, such as those that were printed in Europe, the big ones, big fat ones, you know, like the Korban Mincha Siddur or the Siddur of the Rabbi Yaakov Ben Tzvi, the Yavetz, and so on, okay? Those Siddurim, they have services called Ma'amodos. Yeah,
they
have.
They really felt the intensity that they have.
Right, and it consists of selections from the Bible, special prayers, tilim, and so on and so forth. And people would rise up at midnight in order to read Ma'amodos. So they wanted to, you know, they wept really, literally, for the fact that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, and they would pray, you know, that it should be restored again. So in any big siddur, you can always find the Ma'amodos as well.
The big siddur.
The big siddur, right, yeah. So I have several such siddurim at home. And, sometimes I would take one of the siddur with me when I would go, let's say, on the plane to Eretz Yisrael, so that I had something very handy in which I could read selections from the Bible, from the Gemara, and so on and so forth, because they have a whole kind of selection. And over Yom HaKippurim, it says, also on Yom Kippur, also, it has its own special readings.
Right.
Okay. So, Gemara now starts by saying, Tanan Hasam, okay, we read in a different Mishnah, this happens to be in the Mishnah at the very beginning of Maseches Shkolim. There is a tractate by the name of Shkolim, okay? And what is the quotation? It says, "Be'echod ba'Adar, on the first day of Adar, mashmiyad al hashkolim, the al hakilayim." Okay. Next page.
There's a line there again. The line.
Right. Next page. Okay. Yeah. Here we are. Pass it up, please. Okay. Yeah. Kilayim. All right. Which means that on the first day of Adar, public proclamation has to be made, both in reference to Shkolim, in other words, the people have to begin contributing their Shkolim in Beis HaMikdash, right? And also that those people who had farms, and that meant practically the entire Jewish people in those days, because they were essentially an agricultural people, they have to be careful to uproot any mixture of, let's say, vegetables in the midst of grain or something like that, that's a kilayim,
right.
Kilayim refers to different things.
Right.
This is kilei hakera, okay? Kilayim, literally, with the vineyard, which the Torah has prohibited, and therefore, by extension, the rabbonim took it also for fields in general. That you have to, when you plant, you don't mix things together. Instead, each one should be in its own separate area. Okay? And then, of course, you have kilei habeged, for example, in which we're not allowed to wear what we call shatneis, you know, a mixture of wool and linen together. That's prohibited, and so on.
Right. Specifically Minotaur.
Right, right. And kilayim could also refer even to, for example, animals. It's written, you know, that you're not allowed to
crossbreed them.
Crossbreed them, exactly.
We can't even yoke them together.
And that's another one, right?
What's that?
You're not allowed to plow with an ox or with a donkey together, and so on, okay? So, the principle of kilayim, you know, extends to many different areas as well, okay? Not allowed, for example, to, let's say, to take two different trees of different species, you know, and mix them together or something like that. Right. Today people are doing it, but why the Torah is for him. The Torah felt that things that the Rebbeinu Shlomo had created, you should not make mixtures of them, but you should treat them each and as separate entities. Have respect for each one.
That's the basic idea.
What?
If somebody does it already, you're allowed to eat the fruit, right?
If it's a goy.
Like a pangelo.
If it's a goy. The guy does. In Eretz Israel, you know, a Jewish farm is not supposed to do it, okay? When we buy esrogim, you'll notice that they'll tell you that the esrog is not only min ha-mufchor. Min ha-mufchor, in other words, finest quality. Chosen quality, literally, right? Right? But also they'll tell you, bilti mukhovim, that these are not hybrids.
Hybrid.
Right, they're not hybrids.
Where
did you
look
at? Borkov. Borkov. Right, mixed together.
Borkov.
So if you take a look at the box, the real, or the piece of paper that comes with
the mixture.
Right.
I have a class question. Which is this. From what we just learned about clients, it would seem to me that we Jews are not allowed to eat like genetically altered fruits and vegetables, of which there are a lot, or for instance in any other form of like cloning. But let's just stick. Let's leave aside the science. But you know, there are a lot of genetically altered.
I'm sure that there are. Yeah. Frankly, I don't know. I don't know who is that careful today.
Right.
I don't know. If you're a farmer, then it's another story, okay? But if you're not a farmer, something that gets
right.
Exactly. Right.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah. All right.
Technically,
we shouldn't, but in reality, people do anyway. Yeah, that's correct.
Everything in the markets today has been mixed.
Yeah, but all right. The tomatoes, they're mixing, let's say, one tomato seed with a different type of
tomato seed.
I mean, that's not exactly the same category.
But let's say a lot of graft trees. In other words, let's say they make today the very popular tree is a weeping willow. They cross a willow with a cherry tree. A weeping cherry tree.
Strictly speaking, it probably would be prohibited.
Prohibited. I had one on my property in New Jersey. I should have said. But a peach, a borer came along and destroyed it.
Oh, okay. Did the job for you.
Isn't a nectarine a mixture to begin with? A nectarine. Is that a pure? Isn't that a mixture?
Probably.
Probably.
But we all eat them anyway.
Yeah.
Half the time it has no tongue, but that's a different thing.
Right.
All right. So at any rate, why does the Mishnah in Shkolim say that on the first day of Adar we have to make a public proclamation, which means in the various shuls, no matter where they be, right, both concerning Shkolim and also the Kilayim, right? So they say, Bishlamal HaKilayim, right, the top line over there, says, okay, this makes sense when it comes to the question about Kilayim. Excuse me. This Mansriahi, because this is the time when people are planting, and presumably by the time that the first day of Adar has come, you can begin to see sprouts, and you can tell, you know, whether they're all of the same species, or is there a mixture? In which case, then what do you have to do? Then you have to pull out the offending ones, okay? Excuse me. But how do we know that this is the time when we have to make a proclamation to people to start in to send in their shekels to the Beis HaMikdash? How do we know that? Excuse me, my voice is not so why. All right.
You want to drink?
No, I'll be all right. just
those nuts.
Wait, maybe it's not such a bad idea. Omar Abtabi. So Abtabi said, Omar Rabbi Yoshua, so the name of Rabbi Yoshua, he said, the Omar Kroh, we have a pasuk that speaks about this. It says, Zos Olas Chodesh Bechodsho. This is the offering, the burnt offering, literally, of each month in its proper month. Okay. But why does it say Chodesh Bechodsho, month in its month? So he says, understand it as Omer Torah. Torah says, Chadesh Behave Kobe Mitruma Chadosh. Says Bechodsho means as it becomes renewed. As what comes renewed? On a certain Rosh Chodesh, there is a time for a renewal of the cycle of Korbanos. Torah says, in other words, do something new and bring a sacrifice from the new offering that has been offered. Okay? The Kevon de Benison. And inasmuch as we have established in another place that on the first of Nisan we have to begin to bring sacrifices from the new offerings, we're not allowed to use any more the offerings of the previous year for that purpose. You understand? So Kadminon, therefore, we start early. The Karinon, and we proclaim the Echad the Ador, we read on the first day of Ador, right? Kehechi the Leisuf Shekolim the Mikdash, in order that we could be sure that people will send their Shekolim to the Beis HaMikdash, that the Beis HaMikdash will have, by the first of Nisan, enough money in order to be able to take care of the sacrifices for the new year that begins at that time. So he says, come on. In accordance with whose opinion is the Mishnah that says that on the first day of Adar we begin with these proclamations? He says, the Loka Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. This could not be the opinion of Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. The Yi Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, because if it were his opinion, Ha'omar, didn't he say that Shtei Shabbos, that we have to do it only for 2 weeks or two Sabbaths, whichever way you want to translate, it's the same thing, right? Prior to what? To Rosh Chodesh Nisan. In other words, he felt that 2 weeks would be enough in order to gather the shkolim that they would need for the new one. Yeah. Whereas the Mishnah here speaks about, you know, that obviously we need not 2 weeks, but we need 4 weeks in order for it to take place. Tanya, we've learned another...
Right.
No, is that a Dalit over there? My book.
D'Tanya.
Yeah, it's D'Tanya. My book is a little rubbed out. That's the reason why I'm asking. Right. D'Tanya. Yes. As we have learned, it says, Shou alin b'hilchos ha-Pesach k'idol ha-Pesach shloshim yoy. We have another teaching, which we find in various places. But anyway, it says that we begin asking questions, or we begin explaining various halachas of Pesach, right? Prior to Pesach, 30 days. In other words, 30 days prior to Pesach is the time that you will begin asking questions and making preparations for Pesach. Okay? And so then, when would that be? That would be actually as soon as Purim is over. You begin preparing for Pesach at that particular time. So,
Pesach is 6 weeks after Purim, right? Yeah.
Pesach is only 4 weeks.
Only
4 weeks. Right. 30 days to be exact. It's 30 days after. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So, that being the case, then that would be more in accordance with whose opinion? With Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, who said that 2 days are enough, right? Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, Omer Shtei Shabbosos, all right? That's the reason why he says that 2 weeks prior to Rosh Chodesh Nisan would be enough.
To prepare for the...
To prepare for the Shkolim. Oh. Right. Okay. So he says, or even to prepare for Pesach. Because,
Pesach.
All right. So he says, Afilu Temer Avin Shimon Gamliel says, well, okay, Maybe even Rabbi Shimon Bar Leo would agree, however, that the first of Adar also requires public notice. Why? Kaven de Omer Mar, Bachamisha also Bo, inasmuch as we have another teaching which says that the bankers, literally the people, the money changers, okay? Shulchan, in this case over here, obviously doesn't mean tables, but it means people who set up tables in order to do business. What business are we talking about?
Money.
They exchange money. Let's say that you have a Roman coin, okay? But for Pesach, you have to change it. For the shkolim, you have to change it into shkolim. Yeah. So therefore, these people would do the money changing. Okay. So it says. Well, we'll see. For time being, it says not in the Beis Hamikdash. All right. Bachamisha Zabur Shacholus Yoshvin by Medina. By Medina means any place outside of.
In the city.
In the city, we've had it, right. Any place outside the Beis HaMikdash.
Right.
Okay. Which could be anywhere. It could be, it could be even in Yerushalayim outside the Beis HaMikdash. But it could also be, let's say, in, Be'er Sheva.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
So,
wherever Jews are living, okay. So that's by Medina. When the Chof Hay, however, when the 25th day of Adar came, which of course would be just about a week prior to Rosh Chodesh, right? So Yoshim Bamikdash, then they would sit in the Beis Hamikdash itself. That's where they would then establish themselves, because people were coming in order to contribute at that time, and also with the intention of obviously. Begin to think in terms of what sacrifices they're going to bring with them when they come on the pilgrimage. So money changers were busy over there. Of course, the New Testament, I don't have to tell you,
they
put a very bad slant on the whole deal. Yeah. And,
Did they charge?
We don't know.
That's not mentioned. They must have done something.
They may have had an exchange.
I
would think.
Isn't that outlawed? Yeah. We're not supposed to charge it.
That's right.
I don't know whether they did make it. It's not made clear. It's not clear that they made any money.
It's a fee. Yeah.
A fee or
a
lot of
money,
right?
A fee. A fee for
a
service.
History by Shlomo Zeitlin.
Shlomo Zeitlin discusses
this, and he says that they actually performed a very valuable service because people that came, let's say from Babel, wanted to buy a sheet, a kit.
Yeah, okay, right.
They might have whatever, let's say they had a
shoe. Right, right, I understand.
And the Judean farmer would not really know the worth of a dinar, so they would make the exchange.
Cloud exchange, there's no question.
Sometimes the money changers might take advantage of, let's say, a simple Judean farmer or whatever, and not giving the right value or something.
Generally,
they performed a very, very valuable
service.
Right.
He was editor for a long time at Jewish Quarterly.
He believes in the Oral Torah.
He taught in Gratz College.
One about the Hellenistic period and the other about the Roman period.
It would be literal, yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah. So, at any rate, all right, I'm going to make a stop in a few moments. I don't know if you remember, we read that Kadmina Vit Korinin, all right, it said that if, let's say, Rosh Chodesh Ador fell in the middle of the week, then on the Shabbos prior to it, what did they read? Said that they read Parsha Shkolim. So God's fine. Everybody knows what Parsha Shkolim is. The answer is no. In those days, there was a controversy as to what is the proper one. So I'll just introduce it, and then we'll say the rest for next week of your Tasha. Okay? My Parsha Shkolim, what is the actual reading that they were supposed to read? So Rav Amar, Rav said, Tzav is b'nei Yisrael v'mati lehem skomani lachmi. That this is the passage that you have to read. Namely, it deals with the Tamidim. It deals with the two daily sacrifices that were carried on. And of course, you know, this we read every Rosh Chodesh, as well as also, it should be part of our daily prayers as well. That's besides the point, okay? So, at any rate, this to him represented the reading which was appropriate for Parsha Shkolim. Shmuel Omar, but Shmuel said, Ki Sisa. But what we have to read is the Parsha of Ki Sisa, Rosh Bnei Israel, of Kuleim, right? That when you take a sense of Jewish people, the Nosnu, each one is to give, each Kofa Nafsho, the Talmud for his soul. And then what does he have to give? He has to give Machzis HaShekel, B'Shakel HaKodesh, Nehav HaShekel, B'Shakel HaKodesh. And then as we'll see, when we study it next week, in Be'etz Hashem, that there are three mentions, in just in those few verses over there, of the word Shkolim.
That's why okay, we give Shekel. Three points.
Yes, so this became the basis of the custom that on Purim, you'll see that they put in three tellers, and then it's called Matzis HaShekel Gels. Okay.
So we're pretty close to the end.
We're in Choftes, Amit Beis right now.
We go to Amit Aleph, and Amit Beis.
That is correct. Correct.
Are we going to stop at Ki Tesa? Where exactly are you going to stop?
No, I'm going to stop at this point right now, and I'll start from here next week. Because my voice...
is getting weaker.
Right. All right, today is February the 12th of the year 2003. We are continuing from where we left off in Maseches Megillah, and we are on Daf Choftes Amud Beis. We are on page 29b. Okay? Now, the Mishnah, if you recall, spoke about the fact that Rosh Chodesh Adar, there are certain things that we have to do, but specifically the Torah reading says that we have to read Parsha Shkolim, which is fine, except that two great authorities disagreed as to what the sections are. It's a question, according to Rav, it is the passage that we find in our Chumash, in the Hirsch Chumash, on page 694. If we take a look at it for a moment, you'll see that the passage begins...
Which number?
Beginning with chapter 28.
Okay.
Yeah. Where it says that, this is the daily sacrifice that you have to observe in its proper time. And what is it? So that Kavosim Neshonot Tamimim, they have to be, there are two of them that are involved. They have to be within the first year. In other words, they have to be, young lambs. And they have to be perfect, no blemish, whatever. And two every single day, Shtayim Layom Olatamit. And this would be a perpetual bird sacrifice. And one of them you do in the morning, right? So here's the
second one. Exactly, of what we had in this week's
project. Yeah. To a certain extent, right. Except that.
About the two lambs, morning and night.
Yeah, right. It is mentioned in Parsha Tetzaveh. That is correct. That's correct.
Daily.
Yeah.
Because the question came up, how come never thought of it before? We're talking last night about it.
Uh-huh.
That even on Shabbos, they are shechting and burning.
Yes, correct. Right.
Yeah.
Hi, Sal. How are you?
Which is normally for other things prohibited.
Yeah.
And on Yom Tovim as well.
Yeah. In Tetzaveh, the emphasis is first upon the inauguration of the Kahanim into being, priests and the service and so on. But then it also mentions that among their functions are also to take charge of the daily sacrifices as well. But this is considered the source over here, right? Because it tells you, specifically in the morning, one in the evening, and so on. And also, what is the libation that has to be offered with them? It's what we call the Nesach, Reniska, Reisahin, fourth of a hin, for one, and so on. And the second one, of course, has to be slaughtered Bein Harbayim, which means literally towards evening, so that therefore, you know, it would be sometime in the afternoon prior to sunset, okay? And then, following it, as you see, we have, first of all, what we call Musafim. What do we mean by Musaf? I mean, we all know Musaf, rise for Musaf. But our prayer is there really to correspond to the sacrifice, the additional sacrifice, what Musaf means in this case, the additional sacrifice that was offered either on Shabbos or on the various occasions that are going to be mentioned in the text in the next two chapters, okay? So that following the daily sacrifice, they mention first what is the additional sacrifice for Shabbos, and then the next passage, if you'll see, beginning with verse 11, Shabbos is the one, verses 9 and 10, as you can see on page 695, right? For Rosh Chodesh, they mention the reading, what, you know, the additional sacrifices for that day, and that would be from verses 11 through 15, okay?
But wait a minute, nine says on the Sabbath, two he lambs.
Yeah.
The first year.
This is an addition. This, remember, these additional ones.
Addition,
that's why it's called Musaf. In addition to the daily sacrifice.
The daily sacrifice,
so this
one
is
in the morning,
right,
at night.
Right.
So now we're having the additional.
That's correct.
Two lambs, which it doesn't say when. Does it tell when they are going to?
No, but it could be any time during the day. However, the Gemara in Brachas, according to Rabbi Yehuda's opinion, he says that the Musaf was normally slaughtered not later than the beginning of the seventh hour. So in other words, roughly about somewhere between 12 and 1 o'clock in the afternoon. This is when they offered up the additional sacrifices, okay? By then, that's what, actually they could do it earlier than that too.
Your car is beeping. Yes, your alarm or something.
Oy vey.
And what was the drink on?
This is a libation of wine that was poured on the altar, okay? So that's what they mean by the drink offering. In Hebrew, the word for that is nesach.
Okay, so now we're...
Yeah. Right. So then you see Rosh Chodesh, right. And then after that... Right. And then following it, you have the sacrifices for Pesach, as you'll notice, right? That would be beginning with verse 16, would be for Pesach. Right,
yeah.
And special, you know, the first and the first day was different from the Chol HaMoed and so on. But actually, on all days, it's written that they offered a similar sacrifice. Okay, and then after that, you have, of course, for Shavuos. And then after Shavuos, you have Rosh Hashanah. And then you have Yom Kippur, and finally, of course, the sacrifices that were offered on Sukkot. So we see. Musafim were offered on Shabbos, on Rosh Chodesh, and on all the major holidays. Okay? Alright, so these are all additional sacrifices besides the daily sacrifice that was offered. Okay? Alright, now, specifically, what concerns us over here in the passage that we are now discussing in the Gemara is the fact that according to Rav, what should they read on Har Shishkolim? Understand? And according to Rav, what they should read is Tzavos B'nai Yisrael, in other words, 694, what we went over.
Yeah.
That, and of course, continuing with, you know, through the Rosh Chodesh reading. You understand? Okay, so this is Rav's opinion. But, at the same... Yeah.
In other words, he thinks just that we should read
the regular one, and then all the way up until through verse 15, because that deals with Rosh Chodesh, Shabbos and Rosh Chodesh, you understand?
Okay. there's a new moon, 11 to 15.
Right. Okay.
Just the ones dealing with Shabbos and Rosh Chodesh on Shabbos Purim.
Yeah, but he says it should be the entire passage, beginning with the beginning of the chapter.
Right, I understand.
Okay?
Through to the end of the...
Right. Okay? This is Rob's opinion. All right. no, I have to tell you...
Is this a question of when celebrity attack? Is that what it is? When the tax should be collected?
Okay, correct. Remember that the Mishnah previously had said that on Rosh Chodesh Adar, okay,
yeah,
they have to read this in this passage, and then when we studied the Gemara, so they quoted another thing from Masechta Shkalim, that on the first day of Adar, public proclamation was made to people concerning two things. One of them is the shkolim, that they should bring, started to bring in the matzah shekel, the half shekel, and the other thing was kilayim, that if they see, you know, in the field that there's a mixture of plants, they have to tear out in order to make sure that they would not be in contravention, you know, of the mitzvah of the Torah, okay, which says, you know, which forbids kilayim in the field, and also, as we saw, kilayim in clothing, right? Okay, so that is Rob's opinion. This is what we have to read, he says, on Shabbos, Parsha Shekolim, if it is Rosh Chodesh Adar. Okay? That's his opinion.
Okay. I'm going to ask a question about Adar. If it's Rosh Chodesh Adar.
Yes.
What happens in a leap year? An Adar or Adar?
Okay, as far as that's concerned, then you have to repeat it again the second. Yeah. But that would be a different problem.
Yeah, because you don't have a Shkola in twice.
Okay. See, that thing brings us to what we had earlier in this year about what is the difference between first Adar and second Adar.
Yeah.
Okay. And we saw that the basic difference between first and second Adar is that Purim should be observed in the second Adar. Why in the second Adar? Because it is closer to Pesach. And we had the principle that we want to have, we want to join together one redemption, namely the redemption of the Jewish people in the days of Mordechai and Esther, right? With the redemption from Egypt. Okay.
Therefore, the Shkolem would be in the second Adar.
So, in that particular case, correct. Our practice today is that Shkolim is in connection with the second Adar, and all the special Shabbosim that follow, Zohar, Pora, and HaChodesh, which we spoke about last week, that all of them take place in second Adar, or as close to second Adar as possible. Okay? But, excuse me, boy, my voice, I'm having problems tonight. But back in the old days, when everything was by observation, and they did not know until the end of the month whether they're going to make a leap year or not, then in that particular case, it was quite possible to have Shkolim, right, and Zohar, and Purim, etc., and then at the end of the month, they decided, whoa, it's time to make an Ibrayor. And in that case, then you have to go through it again, you see. So, So, we, of course, since our calendar is fixed, so we know that it's all in connection now, you know, with second Adar. However, we don't want to forget about the fact that Purim is important. So, what we have, and this will be coming up next week, we have what we call Purim Katan and Shushan Purim Katan. In other words, little Purim and little Shushan Purim. These are days that we observe not to recite Tachton on these days, okay?
And it only happens on a leap year?
It can only happen in the leap year.
Right,
because we're having
Adar.
It in first Adar to correspond to, the real holidays and so the real events which will be observed in second Adar, okay? All right. Now, again, we repeat. This is what Rav said This is what Shkolem is. Why he said that, we'll see when we go over the Gemara. Okay? But what was Shmuel's opinion? Shmuel's opinion was that Shkolem, you read Parsha Kisisa. So let's take a look at that. That's much shorter.
Okay.
Alright, Kisisa you find on page 352.
Is this a different tax or an additional tax or the same tax? Only mentioned in a different place.
Hold off, I'll answer all your questions. Okay. Alright. Let's take a look right now at 352.
Double taxation, we don't go for that.
Well.
Not without representation anyway, right?
Okay. The first verses of Parsha Kisisa. All right?
Yeah.
Beginning with verse 11 and going through, I guess, let's see, what's the number? Verse 16, okay? Moshe Rabbeinu is commanded by the Rabbeinu Shel Olam to take a census of the people of Israel, right? And how do you take the census? You take the census by each one giving a shekel. All right. Now, as we'll see, you take a look at the verse 13. Zayit nu, right? Kol oivav kodim, whoever, in other words, passed muster. In other words, is old enough for service and so on. As an adult, he has to give what machzis hashekel, a half shekel, the shekel hakodesh, in the shekel which was for the sanctuary. In other words, this was a purer shekel than what might circulate otherwise, okay? It has more silver content in it, okay?
Only the men had to pay the taxes, the women didn't.
Yeah, correct. Right.
Yeah,
well, it's
one.
Yeah. And then it says, it gives how much silver was in there, so it says that's from Gera HaShekel, right? The shekel has to have 20 Gera and so on. This is half a shekel that you have to pay, okay? And this is true more
Lashem. Did they weigh these as they came through? They know?
Well, that's a good question. Maybe they had scales. Because once upon a time, that's true. When did the coinage start? It started a later period, more or less. Yeah. Right. Certainly after Matan Torah started, right. Yeah. Wasn't there at that time. Okay. So, it's quite possible, in other words, that they weighed and so on. Or people would weigh it themselves at home and they would give the equivalent
to it.
All right, the money changes we learned. Well, we learned with the money changes. The problem was that, again, quoting last week, we had that passage from Shkolim, Tractate Shkolim, where it says